it help if I turn this light off up here? The light overhead, would it help for me to turn that off? No, doesn't matter? Okay. I hadn't done that yet, and I wondered if that might help. Well, good evening, everybody. It's good for me to see you, although I think some of you saw me last week, but I didn't get to see any of you. I'm thankful for the technology that allows for us to meet like that on a wintry Wednesday evening for a Bible study, but it's much better to meet in person. So this week we're going to be talking about seals number 5 and 6 in the 6th chapter of Revelation. If you weren't able to catch the YouTube stream from last week we talked about seals 1 through 4. And that's in the first 8 verses of Revelation chapter 6. And just as a reminder, John received this series of visions on the island of Patmos during the reign of Domitian. We think it was probably somewhere around 96 AD. And as is stated at the beginning of the book, the series of visions, the series of seals being opened started fairly quickly after that point. Seal number 1, we talked about this last week, represents the age of the Antonines, 5 emperors that followed Domitian, beginning with the emperor Nerva and ending with the emperor Marcus Aurelius, who's here on this coin to your left. And if you'll notice up here, I don't know how well you can see that because he's got these curly locks, but there on the side is the crown, the Stephanos, the crown of victory that the emperors wore when they entered Rome after securing victory in battle. And we talked about the Stephanos, the crown on the rider, the first rider in the first seal, who is riding a white horse, which represents uninhibited victory. I believe that represents the age of the Antonines. Seal number 2 describes the period of time following the Antonines. The Antonines were sort of the height of the Roman Empire. It reached its greatest extent. It was a time of peace and prosperity, but that was followed by a century of civil war, and that's represented by seal number 2. And then as a consequence of a tremendous amount of political instability, Rome fell into an economic depression and a famine in the mid-3rd century, the mid-200s AD, and that's represented by seal 3. You might remember the rider who has balances in his hands, and it talks about weighing out various ingredients for making bread, and we talked about how that in the Bible represents a time of economic depression, inflation, and eventually famine. And as is the case, what usually follows famine are plagues, and Rome was affected by a series of plagues over a period of about 15 years. And also, you have gathering on the boundaries of the Roman Empire a lot of different foreign nations. You might see them sometimes described as the Germanic tribes. The Romans called them barbarians, but they were actually more moral in some respects than the Romans were. But that's a whole other rabbit trail to chase for another time. But seal number 4 represents plague and war. So you've got the civil war happening, but also you've got external enemies beginning to mount against the empire. You've got plague, and those are what I believe are the historical events that link up with what's commonly called the four horsemen of the apocalypse. That's just a quick review, and that gets us to seal number 5, which is in Revelation chapter 6, verses 9 through 11. Let's just take a moment to read that. Revelation chapter 6, beginning in verse 9, the fifth seal. When he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth?" Then a white robe was given to each of them, and it was said to them that they should rest a little while longer until both the number of their fellow servants and their brethren who would be killed as they were was completed. Now on the slide, I call this the martyr's prayer because that's really what this is. You have those who have been killed for the sake of their faith in Jesus Christ asking Jesus, how long will it be before their deaths are avenged? So John sees an altar, and an altar, I think we can all understand, would be a symbol of sacrifice because either an animal would be offered on an altar, or in the case of the tabernacle and later the temple, you had the altar of incense, which sat right in front of the veil, which separated the holy place from the most holy place. And the incense would be burned every day, and it would fill the holy place and would work its way into the most holy place. And that's a highly symbolic idea. As we notice back in chapter number 4, the 24 elders held bowls of incense in their hand, and the incense represents the prayers of the saints. So an altar is a symbol of sacrifice, whether it be the sacrifice of our lips, whether it be the sacrifice that occurs on the altar of burnt offering or the altar of incense. John also sees souls underneath that altar. And the reason he sees souls is these are people who have died, but they're not yet resurrected, right? We're in a time period where we are between their death and the resurrection. So these are disembodied people, if you will. And what this indicates is they have an awareness. They have a memory of what's happened to them in the past, and they are aware in some sense that others are suffering for the cause of Christ. So there's a consciousness that's at work here. To comfort these people, they are each given a white robe. And, of course, white represents innocence and purity. And a white robe is what's given to the faithful. You might remember in chapter 4, verse number 4, the 24 elders are clothed in white robes. And then later on in chapter 7, and hopefully we'll have time to get to this later, in verses 13 and 14, John sees a great multitude that's all clothed in white robes. And one of the elders who's speaking with him says in verse 14 that these are the ones who come out of the great tribulation and washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. And we'll talk about what that means, hopefully, here in a few minutes. So white robes are the comfort, the consolation, that the reward that Jesus gives to faithful servants. These people were faithful until death, and they are comforted by the Lord with this reward of a white robe. All right. What the fifth seal seems to represent is the persecution of the church that happens during the years of 303 to 311 AD. And if you're keeping track, you'll notice that each of these seals is in a sequence, right? And I just want to mention that in choosing historical events that seem to link up with the symbolism, I am choosing major historical events. This is something you should be able to pick up. If you picked up just a simple history of the Roman Empire from the first century onward, you're going to hit all of these major points, even in the most rudimentary history of the Roman Empire. This persecution of the church happens in 303 to 311, but this is by no means the first persecution of the church. In fact, we can account for 10 prominent persecutions under the Roman Caesars. It begins with Nero, Domitian, who had exiled John to Patmos. This is where he receives the letter, also led a persecution of the church. Trajan, Marcus Aurelius, Septimus Severus, Maximus, Decius, Valerian, Aurelian, all of these emperors led persecutions of the church. In 284, Diocletian becomes emperor of the Roman Empire, and his reign begins to stabilize what had been a very chaotic situation. Diocletian was an able administrator and was able to bring to an end all the the assassinations and coup d'etats and struggles for power that had plagued the empire for a century. But Diocletian shared the throne with a couple of other men, one by the name of Galerius. And in 303, Diocletian is pushed by Galerius to stamp out the Christian faith. The reason why they thought this needed to be done was because they perceived Christianity to be a real threat to their power. This was an attempt to consolidate power and promote unity, absolute unity within the empire. And remember, they had already lived through about 100 years of a nihilistic civil war. And as the Roman Empire was basically tearing itself apart, Christianity was steadily growing in converts during this time. So the pagan priests of the Roman religion convinced Galerius and Diocletian that if they wanted to regain the favor of the gods, what they needed to do was to get rid of the Christians, because the Christian prayers were preventing the Roman gods from acting on behalf of Rome. And so to secure unity and to consolidate power within the empire, Diocletian was pushed to promote an empire-wide persecution of the faith. And this is an 8-year period of intense persecution. As far as we can tell, this was the most intense period of persecution ever suffered by the church up to this point. The empire decreed the destruction of all Christian churches, the burning of Christian books, the dissolution of Christian congregations, the confiscation of their property, the exclusion of Christians from public office, and the punishment of death for Christians detected in religious assembly. The Christian historian Eusebius describes some of the grisly things that were suffered by Christians. Men were flogged till the flesh hung from their bones. Their flesh was scraped to the bone with shells. Salt or vinegar was poured on their wounds. The flesh was cut off bit by bit and fed to waiting animals. They were bound to crosses. Men were eaten piecemeal by starving beasts. And the description just goes on and on and on. It was an incredibly brutal time. And it's just almost impossible to describe how horrific some of these things were. And I don't think it probably is very beneficial for us to go into a lot of detail. So seal number 5 is representative of the time of persecution that would follow the civil war, the economic depression, plagues, and the external enemies beginning to infringe on the borders of the empire. Christian persecution reached its height under Diocletian, and those under the altar want to know how long God is going to allow this to last. Those martyrs who had died for Christ in the time of John are representative of all those who will die for the cause of Christ in the future. And they want to know, how long are you going to tolerate this, God? How long are you going to allow these wicked people to persecute your people? And what we see happening is the prayer of the martyrs in seal number 5 is answered by the 7 trumpets. And we'll link that up probably next week when we get into Revelation chapter 8. So God does hear this prayer, and he does respond with the 7 trumpets. That's how I understand seal number 5. We get into seal number 6, and that starts in Revelation chapter 6, verse number 12. And let's go ahead and take a moment to read verses 12 through 17. I looked when he opened the 6th seal, and behold, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became like blood. And the stars of heaven fell to the earth as a fig tree drops its late figs when it is shaken by a mighty wind. Then the sky receded as a scroll when it is rolled up, and every mountain and island was moved out of its place. And the kings of the earth, the great men, the rich men, the commanders, the mighty men, every slave and every free man, hid themselves in the caves and in the rocks of the mountains, and said to the mountains and rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne, and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of his wrath has come, and who is able to stand? I believe the 6th seal represents the reign of Constantine and the remaking of the Roman Empire. And by remaking, I mean that Constantine transformed the Roman Empire from one that was governed and ruled by the pagan religion to one that was Christian, or called Christian, in its orientation. Constantine led a real revolution and changed things in ways that may be difficult for us to relate to. Before we get into the interpretation of the sixth seal, though, I just want to point something out. And I put commas between these sixes because I thought that might spook some people out if I just put 666. Although we're going to talk about what that means when we get into chapter 13. It doesn't mean what some people think it means. But anyways, there is an interesting bit of linkage between the sixth seal, the sixth trumpet, and the sixth bowl. Each of these are longer than their five predecessors. In fact, sixth seal lasts from chapter 6, verse 12, all the way down through chapter 7, verse 17. So it's a long part of this particular series. The sixth trumpet, the sixth seal, and the sixth bowl are all longer than their five predecessors. And each of them serve a very important purpose. They're basically establishing the need for what comes after. In the case of the sixth seal, it sets up the need for the seven trumpets in chapters 8 through 11. And we'll see that linkage when we get into chapter 7 in particular. The sixth trumpet, which we'll talk about probably toward the end of next month, the sixth trumpet foreshadows the 1,260-year time period that's described in chapters 12 through 14. So the sixth trumpet that happens in at the last half of chapter 9 and includes chapter 10 and on into chapter 11, it's a very long part of the trumpets, it foreshadows the need for this description of the 1,260-year time period in chapters 12 through 14. And the sixth bowl prepares the faithful for what we often call Armageddon. And Armageddon, I believe, is depicted in chapters 19 and 20. So each of these symbols, the sixth symbol in these series, foreshadows the need for what's going to come after. And I think that's just an interesting, I won't call it coincidence, I think it's in there by design. So in the sixth seal, let's talk about what John sees for a moment. He sees a great earthquake. And an earthquake, I believe, represents a great political or religious upheaval and commotion. Y'all remember the song, "There's a Whole Lot of Shaking Going On"? Yeah, when did that song come out? Like 50s, early 60s, something like that? And what was happening? There was a lot of commotion, right? There was a whole lot of shaking going on in America at the time. America was going through a very interesting and consequential series of transformations in that time period. That's what an earthquake represents. You've got political and religious upheaval or commotion. You also have in this vision, John sees mountains. Sorry, I'm having a little hard time getting this thing to. All right, well, we'll just do it this way. John sees mountains, and he also sees islands. And each one of these represent kingdoms or governments. And if you're wondering how I come to those conclusions, again, I refer you back to the table of symbols. And in that table of symbols, I give you some scriptures to look at to kind of see why I interpret the symbols this way. And he also sees in this things happening to the sun, the moon, and the stars. And if you did your assignment in preparation for this study this last week, you're probably already a little bit familiar with that particular piece of imagery. And it seems that the sun growing dark, the moon growing dark, the stars growing dark, all point toward a tremendous political shakeup. What we're seeing in this seal are the kingdoms of this world going through a time of transformation, and it's not a very pleasant time of transformation. Things are unstable. Things aren't quite what they should be or what people think they should be. I should put it that way. Let's talk about the meaning of the sun, moon, and stars. The sun represents an important person politically. The moon represents someone of importance, but of lesser importance. And remember, the moon doesn't have its own light. It simply reflects the light of the sun. So it's an important body. It, for example, governs the tides here on Earth. We depend on the moon for a lot of different things. So it's important, but it's not as important as the sun. The stars, in all likelihood, represent just people in general, a multitude of people. And to establish the reason why I interpret the sun, moon, and stars in this way, I just want to bring out three passages that I think put some real meat on these bones. Remember in Genesis chapter 1, verses 16 through 18, when God created the sun, moon, and stars, he created the sun to rule the day, and he created the moon to rule the night, right? So the sun and moon are rulers, or that's at least how God describes them when he creates them in Genesis chapter 1. We go a few chapters later to chapter 37, we have the prophet Joseph having a couple of different dreams, and in one dream, he sees the sun, moon, and stars bow down to him. He shares that dream with his family, and as you might recall, his father Jacob, who was also a prophet, says to Joseph, "Are you trying to tell me that your mother and I and your brothers are going to bow down to you?" Jacob understood exactly what the sun, moon, and stars represented. The sun represented Jacob, the moon represented Rachel, and the stars represented his brothers. So you have two significant personages and a multitude of people, if you will. And 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 41, just talks about the heavenly bodies and how each one has a different kind of glory. So the sun has one glory, the moon has another glory, the stars have a different kind of glory. So that's sort of a hierarchy, if you will, within all this. Why is this so important? Why did I give you this assignment? And why am I spending so much time on this? Because this is one of the more easily misunderstood parts of the book of Revelation. When John sees this, he sees a piece of imagery that is prevalent in prophecy. Similar things are said about the collapse and fall of the nation of Babylon in Isaiah chapter 13, verse number 10. I'll just read that verse real quick. "For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be darkened in its going forth, and the moon will not cause its light to shine." And when you put that verse in context, what you see is God is judging the nation of Babylon, and he is forecasting its eventual collapse, its eventual fall. Similar words are said of Egypt in Ezekiel chapter 32, verse number 7. God says, "When I put out your light, I will cover the heavens and make its stars dark. I will cover the sun with the cloud, and the moon shall not give her light." Once the Greeks conquered Egypt, Egypt never was what it was under the pharaohs. God is forecasting a day when Egypt would be judged. So the sun being covered with the cloud, the stars growing dark, the moon not giving her light, all of this is similar language to what we've already read in Revelation chapter 6. It's said about Tyre, Sidon in Philistia in Joel chapter 3, verse 15. "Sun and moon will grow dark, and the stars will diminish their brightness." Jesus says it about Jerusalem in Matthew chapter 24, verse 29. "Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken." So when John sees this particular piece of imagery, this is not something new. This is a very old piece of prophetic language. It's been around for centuries, and it's well established what this particular piece of imagery means. What God intends to communicate is there is a great upheaval happening within the halls of power. And generally, this ends with the collapse of a nation. And that's exactly what we see happening in the days of Constantine, and I'll tell you why here in just a moment, but I want to talk about a couple more things before we get there. In verses 12 through 14, we have an interesting collection of two sevens. Seven is the number of perfection and completeness. We have seven structures of creation that are thrown into tumult. The earth, which of course is shaken up by an earthquake, the sun, moon, and stars, the sky, the mountains, and islands, all of these are affected by what's happening in this particular seal. And then we also have seven classes of men who are thrown into tumult. The kings of the earth, the great men, the rich men, the commanders, the mighty men, the slaves, and the free man. All this imagery portends a cataclysmic shift that affected the entire empire from top to bottom. No one was spared. Everyone was affected by the changes that are taking place in this particular seal. All right. And to just get a sense of how desperate people became in this time, John sees all of these classes of people begging out of fear. Fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. Again, this is very familiar language if you are, if you have a working knowledge of prophecy. In Hosea chapter 10, verse number 8, a book that is dedicated to condemning the northern kingdom of Israel and condemning them and pronouncing judgment upon them. God says, also the high places of Avon, the sin of Israel, shall be destroyed. Thorn and thistle shall grow on their altars. They shall say to the mountains, cover us, and to the hills, fall on us. Jesus says something similar as he's carrying the cross to Golgotha. There are women weeping as they watch him. I'm sure he's just beaten to shreds at this point, bleeding, and just, I'm sure any of us would have been moved by that scene. There's women that are watching this, and they are moved to tears, and he turns to them and says, daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For indeed the days are coming in which they will say, blessed are the barren wombs that never bore and breasts which never nursed. Then they will begin to say to the mountains, fall on us, and to the hills, cover us. So what we have in this seal is a figurative description of people fleeing from the judgment of God. They realize that this is a judgment from God, and they are terrified out of their minds. So what does all of this mean? Well, what this means is that the efforts to stamp out Christianity ultimately failed. In 303, as we talked about a few slides ago, Valerius and Diocletian instigated a persecution of the church. Now, under that persecution, some Christians did recant, but many others stood firm. And over time, the Roman population began to sympathize with the Christians and show their solidarity with their Christian neighbors. And so in 311, after 8 years of fruitless efforts, Galerius, as he was dying, sought to make his peace with the undefeated God of the Christians. He promulgated an act of toleration, recognized Christianity as a lawful religion, and asked for the prayers of the Christians. Will Durant wrote in his book Caesar and Christ that the Diocletian persecution was the greatest test and triumph of the church. There is no greater drama in human record than the side of a few Christians, scorned or oppressed by a succession of emperors, bearing all trials with a fierce tenacity, multiplying quickly, building order while their enemies generated chaos, fighting the sword with the word, brutality with hope, and at last defeating the strongest state that history has known. Caesar and Christ had met in the arena, and Christ had won. So the efforts to stamp out Christianity had failed. And in 305, Diocletian abdicated the throne and opened up the throne to whoever was strongest. In 312, Constantine won a great victory at Red Rocks, not out in Denver, but at Red Rocks over like in the Mediterranean region, right? He wins this great victory at Red Rocks, and this is a significant battle because supposedly Constantine before the battle has a vision, and in that vision he sees the sign of the cross, and he hears a disembodied voice say, in this sign, conquer. Constantine ends up winning the battle, and for that reason, he becomes the first Christian statesman. His mother was reputedly a follower of the Lord, and Constantine had seen three unsuccessful persecutions of Christianity that had not stamped out the faith, but had only led to its growth. He was very impressed with the order, the morality, the submission, and conduct of Christianity. And as his power grew, he favored Christians more and more. Land that was owned by the churches was not taxed. Congregations were supported out of the government treasury, and they built meeting houses. But perhaps the most significant act of Constantine, as far as it pertains to Christianity, was what happened in 325. Constantine convened the Council of Nicaea, and this is a significant historical event. The council was convened in order to settle a dispute over the nature of Jesus. There was a man by the name of Arius who contended that Jesus was a created being and not of the same substance as God the Father. Our Jehovah Witnesses, witness neighbors have a similar belief, as do our Mormon neighbors. They both have a belief that Jesus is a created being and not eternal. This is a doctrine that's very old. It can be traced back at least to Arius and before. The council ends up ruling against Arius, and it declared his teaching heretical. But this was a significant moment. Constantine had called in all the luminaries of the Christian faith, so-called, bishops and the ruling parties of the church. He had convened this council, and this council had decided what was true doctrine. And this is just part and parcel with the developments we see happening in the reign of Constantine. One final thing I want to mention about Constantine is what he does in 330. He moves the capital of the Roman Empire from Rome to Constantinople. Constantinople is now Istanbul. You can visit Istanbul if you go to Turkey. We'll talk a lot about Constantinople when we get to the sixth trumpet next month. Now, what does all this mean? Well, what we see happening in the reign of Constantine is a dramatic shift. Constantine shifts the state religion of Rome from paganism to Christianity. Durant, in his book Caesar and Christ, writes this about the Council of Nicaea. He says it marked the replacement of paganism with Christianity as the religious expression and support of the Roman Empire, and committed Constantine to a more definite alliance with Christianity than ever before. A new civilization based on a new religion would now rise over the ruins of an exhausted culture and a dying creed. The Middle Ages had begun. You might notice that I italicized and underlined new civilization and new religion, because the shift from paganism to Christianity was like giving birth to a completely new country, a new nation. And this is essentially what Constantine accomplished in his rule as emperor. The sixth seal represents the formation of an entirely new Roman Empire. Under Constantine, all levels of government were changed, power was restructured, civil law was redefined, the capital was moved, and the religion of state was changed. Now, you might be thinking back to the imagery in the sixth seal and the fear of God's judgment might be sort of ringing in your ears, and you might be wondering, well, how is Constantine changing from paganism over to Christianity? How is that represented by this piece of symbolism? Well, Gibbon, in his book, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, says this about the change from paganism to Christianity. The ruin of the pagan religion is described by the sophists as a dreadful and amazing prodigy, which covered the earth with darkness and restored the ancient dominion of chaos and night. Now, I just want to point out that both Edward Gibbon and Will Durant are atheists. Neither one of them believed in the Bible. Will Durant was writing in the 1900s. Gibbon was writing back in the 1700s. They had no love for Christianity. But they were at least honest enough to recognize these significant changes and how these changes impacted the Roman Empire. And just to kind of give us maybe a taste of how much this might affect a citizenry, imagine if in 5 years the United States declared Islam the state religion. How would you feel? Every citizen would be urged to convert to Islam. Sharia law would be instituted. Churches and synagogues would be closed and mosques built by the U.S. government. How might that make us feel? It might feel like the heavens are falling. It might feel like our world is turned upside down. So this is no small thing that's being prophesied in the sixth seal. It was a complete change, and it's difficult for us to put ourselves in their sandals, but it must have really rocked their worlds, so to speak. But we're not done with the sixth seal just yet. There's quite a bit more in chapter number 7. This continues on in chapter 7, and let's take a moment just to read verses 1 through 8. Chapter 7, verse 1. After these things, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, on the sea, or any tree. Then I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God, and he cried out with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea, saying, "Do not harm the earth, the sea, or the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads." And I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel were sealed. And then in the next few verses, we have members from 12 tribes, 12,000 members of 12 tribes sealed. 12,000 of Judah, Reuben, Gad, Asher, Naphtali, Manasseh, Simeon, Levi, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, and Benjamin are sealed, making 144,000. So what does all this mean? Well, let's talk about for a moment what John sees. And he begins by noting that this particular part of the vision happens after what he sees in chapter 6. So we have, I guess you might say, the transformation of the Roman Empire, the shift from a pagan-oriented empire to a Christian-oriented empire. So what John is seeing happens after all of these things. And he sees a series of four things, four angels, four corners, and four winds. And remember, the number four is the number of the earth. Now, the four corners doesn't mean that people in Bible times believed that the earth was flat. That's just ridiculous. What it does mean is that people in the ancient world recognized that there were four directions, which kind of gives the earth like four corners, if you will. And what is meant by four corners is that this is going to affect the complete planet, or at least the part that's ruled by the Roman Empire, which is what these people know. The four angels are holding back four winds. Winds represent destructive forces. But there's a fifth angel, and the fifth angel has the seal of the living God. Now, the Lamb, who was given authority to open the seven seals, has been releasing each seal one by one. And as we talked about, a seal was a symbol of ownership. In the Middle Ages, for example, a king would take a piece of hot wax, would place it on a document, then take his signet ring and impress that on that hot wax. And whoever received that correspondence or read that legal document knew that the king's signature was authentic. The fifth angel is going to place a seal on the foreheads of the faithful. And a seal denotes ownership, identification, genuineness, authenticity. What's happening in this is God is separating believers from unbelievers. That's what is meant by sealing the 144,000. So who was sealed? Well, we have 12 tribes, consisting of 12,000 people apiece, or 144,000. The number 12 represents governmental perfection. 12 tribes, 12 apostles. You can take 3 times 4. 3, of course, is the number of God. 4 is the number of the earth, and you get 12. And the number 144,000 doesn't have, in my mind, a very specific meaning other than it's a definite number that represents an indefinite number of faithful to the Lord. It's just a general number. I don't think it was exactly 144,000, but rather this represents a somewhat big group of people, but in a moment I'll tell you what I think the 144,000 represent. All right. So you've got these people sealed, and the ones who are sealed are of the children of Israel. Now, let's remember that John is having this vision on this side of the cross. Who is the true Israel at this time? Well, it's not the biological descendants of Abraham. We can look at passages like Galatians chapter 4, or we can look in the book of Romans in chapters 9 through 11, and we can see that Israel represents God's faithful, whether it be the remnant of Jews who believed in Jesus Christ and were saved by his blood through their confession of faith and their baptism into his death, or whether it be the Gentiles who responded to the call of gospel, of the gospel. This is Israel. It's a spiritual nation. And as verse 3 makes it clear, who is sealed? It's the servants of our God. So the children of Israel represent spiritual Israel, the servants of God. They are sealed with their father's name. And we know that from chapter 14, verse number 1. Remember, the seal is a sign of ownership. And how do we know who belongs to God? Well, they wear the name of God. If you go over to chapter 14, verse number 1, that chapter is reflecting back on chapter 7. And John sees the Lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 having his father's name written on their foreheads. So these are folks who remain faithful to God. And it appears that they remain faithful in the midst of apostasy. If you look at the list of the tribes, you'll notice that there are 2 tribes who are missing. The tribe of Dan and the tribe of Ephraim. Now technically, you could count 14 tribes if you kind of want to, you know, like add all the names together. But remember, Levi was always extracted from the numbering of the tribes, and Joseph turned his blessing over to his 2 sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. They stood in his place. So you really have 14 names, but we also we always reckon them as 12 tribes. So you'll notice in this list that Levi and Joseph are included, but Dan and Ephraim are left out. And I think that there's a very important reason why. If you go back to the book of Judges, in Judges chapter 18, you will notice that Dan was the first tribe to go into idolatry. And that's a pretty gruesome story in Judges 18. It is not for the faint of heart or probably for the young to read what happens there in the latter parts of Judges. It's the consequence of a nation that is guided by moral relativism that is basically doing what is right in their own eyes rather than being guided by the scriptures. Dan is the first tribe to go into idolatry, and Ephraim is the tribe that becomes the primary promoter of idolatry. Ephraim and Judah were sort of the primary tribes of leaders in the early history of Israel. Remember, Joshua came from the tribe of Ephraim, and when the kingdom split after the reign of Solomon, Jeroboam was taken from the tribe of Ephraim. So it's Ephraim who leads the northern tribe further into idolatry. So I think the reason why Dan and Ephraim aren't included in this list is because they were responsible for leading the children of Israel into idolatry. What I think all this means is this 144,000, these 144,000 who are marked, are those who are going to keep themselves free from apostasy during the time of the trumpets. And this is something that will become more clear when we get into chapter 13 in particular. But beginning with the sixth seal in Constantine and the Council of Nicaea, we begin to see an apostasy that has been slowly growing begin to flourish into new life in the fourth, fifth, and sixth centuries. So these 144,000 are, I guess you might say, the remnant of those who lived in the midst of the apostasy and kept themselves free from the influence of those particular developments. Now, the fact that these people are sealed is actually an echo of something that happens back in Ezekiel chapter 9. In Ezekiel chapter 9, Ezekiel is transported by the Holy Spirit from Babylon, where he is with some of the captives of Israel, back to Jerusalem. Jerusalem is still standing at this point. It has not been completely conquered by the Babylonians. Well, I should say it's subject to the Babylonians, but it has not been completely destroyed by the Babylonians. So anyways, Ezekiel is transported by vision from Babylon back to Jerusalem, and God sort of takes him on a tour of the city. And one of the places Ezekiel goes is to the temple. And in the temple, he finds all kinds of examples of idolatry. And God's point is to bring to Ezekiel's attention that there are all sorts of bad things happening back in Jerusalem. So as he's touring the city, he sees six men who I believe are angels. These six men enter by the northern gate of Jerusalem. And the fact that they come in from the north is important because this is where the Babylonians would come from when they finally arrive at Jerusalem to destroy it once and for all. And one of those men, one of these angels, has a writer's inkhorn. And it's interesting. This imagery is just parallel with what John sees in Revelation chapter 7, verse 2. And the man with the writer's inkhorn is told to do something very interesting. He's told to go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and cry over all the abominations that are done within it. So as I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, Jerusalem was completely consumed by idolatry. But there were some people in the city of Jerusalem who were disturbed by this. And God wants those people to know that he is aware of their faithfulness. And he is setting them apart. He is marking them. He is marking those who mourned over the state of affairs. And what this vision in Ezekiel chapter 9, and what the vision in Revelation chapter 7 is intended to communicate is, God sees and claims those who are grieved by apostasy, those who keep their garments clean, those who don't follow after idols, those who don't give in to the influence of false teaching and false doctrine, the doctrine of demons. God sees those people, and he will take care of them. I don't believe that means they'll be delivered from martyrdom. I don't think that means they won't be affected by what happens in the trumpets, but rather God is promising to preserve their souls, which is what we go on to read in verses 9 through 12. Let's just read this real quick. So after John sees the sealing of the 144,000, he looks and beholds a great multitude which no one could number, of all nations, tribes, peoples, and tongues, standing before the throne before the Lamb, clothed with white robes, with palm branches in their hands, and crying out with a loud voice, saying, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." All the angels stood around the throne, and the elders and the four living creatures, and fell on their faces before the throne, and worshiped God, saying, "Amen. Blessing and glory and wisdom, thanksgiving and honor and power and might be to our God forever and ever. Amen." Let's just pause there and go back to the slides. So John sees a great multitude which no one can number. Now this is a group that's different from the 144,000. And what I think this great multitude represents is all the faithful people throughout all the ages. Later on, one of the elders tells John, he tells him in verse number 14, that this multitude is those who come out of the great tribulation. And I just want to say this. I don't believe that there's going to be the great tribulation. Like, a period in time when the people of God will be persecuted more than other times. I put a lot of stock in what Paul says in 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse number 12. Yes, and all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. The Great Tribulation is what Christians have been enduring for the last 2,000 years. And even though we've had it fairly easy here in America, there are other spots in this world where people are really suffering for the cause of Jesus Christ. That is the Great Tribulation. John called himself the partner of those in the tribulation back in chapter number 1. So the Great Tribulation is something that all Christians go through. It's not something that happens at a specific point in time, but rather it is a perpetual thing. These people were taken from all tribes, nations, peoples, and tongues. So these are folks from all over the world. And they hold in their hands palm branches, and that might make you think of Jesus entering the city of Jerusalem prior to his crucifixion, how they laid palm branches down and welcomed him as the Messiah. Palm branches are a symbol of victory. And God is blessed with a sevenfold blessing. Blessing, glory, wisdom, thanksgiving, honor, power, and might. That's another one of those sevenfold statements of praise that we find all throughout the book of Revelation. Remember, seven is the number of perfection or completeness. All right. So these are the folks who come out of the Great Tribulation, and I believe that represents all the faithful for all time. So we have a specific group of people, this 144,000. They are the ones who are going to live through this time of apostasy. They are the ones who God has sealed. They are the one who God recognized. And they are one part of a greater host. And the message seems to be that these 144,000 are just one piece of the pie, so to speak. That they are noteworthy. They are worthy to take note of, but they are just one part of the rest of the faithful. And these that come out of the Great Tribulation are rewarded with seven blessings. Or seven things are said about them, I should say. These folks wash their robes, that's us really, they wash their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. They are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. He who sits on the throne will dwell among them. They shall neither hunger anymore nor thirst anymore. The sun shall not strike them nor any heat. The Lamb will shepherd them and lead them to living fountains of waters. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. So what we have is a sevenfold assurance to the faithful. That if you wash your robes in the blood of the Lamb, if you hold true to your faith in Jesus Christ, if you endure persecution for the sake of Jesus Christ, God will bless you. He will make sure that your soul is fed, that you do not have spiritual thirst. You'll go through difficult times, but you will endure them. And as a reward, the Lamb will shepherd us, shepherd you to the living fountains of water, which I believe points toward the picture of heaven in chapters 21 and 22. And of course, the promise God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. And what I think is intended to be communicated in chapter 7 is this is a book of comfort, a book of hope, that if you put your confidence and trust in the Lord, no matter where you live, no matter what time of history you live in, God has a place for you in his kingdom. Now, I am out of time, and I'm almost out of slide. Let me go ahead and ring the bell, and I'll ask for questions. Any questions or comments you all want to make as kids are coming up? Yeah, I'd be glad to. Nope, that's not the previous slide. Let's try this one. Is that what you wanted?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's seven statements made about those who endure the Great Tribulation. Anybody? Yeah, Mark, go ahead. Yeah.
The end of chapter 6.
Yeah.
It says, he who sits on the throne and from they're calling out, protect us from the face of him who sits on the throne, the wrath of the Lamb. So I always kind of go two ways on this one because, mm-hmm. I mean, it's, to me, it's a pretty obvious reference back to chapter 5 of the person of God on the throne and the Lamb is Jesus. But I also take it maybe he who sits on the throne is Constantine.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that could be.
And the wrath of the Lamb is the obvious, easier one to understand.
Yeah, don't get tripped up by the hymn being capitalized. That's not inspired, right? That's the translators doing a little bit of inference there. Go ahead.
It's not capitalized in mine.
So. Well, the New King James it is, so don't be fooled by that. Yeah, it could be Constantine. Sure. Yeah, thank you very much. Any other questions or comments? Well, I want to just use one more slide real quick. Randy, did you get that? Did you need that slide? Anybody else need any other slides? Nope? Okay. Let's get over to my last slide here. I want to close this evening with something Paul says to the Philippians in Philippians chapter 1, verses 27 through 29. Only let your conduct be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or am absent, I may hear of your affairs, that you stand fast in one spirit, with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel, and not in any way terrified by your adversaries, which is to them a proof of perdition, but to you of salvation, and that from God. For to you it has been granted on behalf of Christ not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for his sake. It's good for us to remember that the people who were converted to Christ in the first century were converted under the threat of almost immediate persecution. If they weren't persecuted by the local Jewish population, they would soon run afoul of the local Roman or Greek population. And many congregations were born under direct threat of persecution. I'm thinking of the church in Thessalonica, for example, which was persecuted very early in its existence. It happened so quickly that Paul was only able to spend a few weeks with that congregation, and he was worried whether or not they had remained faithful to the Lord. The point I want to really draw out is something he says about our adversaries. He says we should not be terrified of our adversaries. And if we do not fear them, if we face them with courage and boldness, that will be to them a proof of perdition. We've read about the judgment of him who sits on the throne and the wrath of the Lamb. And when they beg the mountains and the rocks to cover them, that's proof of God's judgment. That's proof of perdition. That the boldness of the church, the faith and courage of the faithful are a testimony to those who stand opposed to Jesus Christ and his servants. But if this evening you're not a part of that church, we want to encourage you to consider what Jesus Christ has done for you. Death is something that worries you, if it makes you afraid, if it keeps you up at night because you know you have sins, then tonight you can have those sins washed away by the blood of Jesus Christ. That fear can be relieved. You can walk out of these doors this evening with no fear, because your soul is safe with Jesus. So if we can help you obey the gospel this evening, please tell us how we can help as we stand and sing the number that Doug has selected.